So, how do you like my t-shirt? Those of you who can't see it, it just has one word across the front. It says, me. This is from a Halloween costume. This is Barbara McHugh's inspiration. We went to a Halloween party, and I went as self, and she went as not self. So that may give you a hint about tonight's topic. And this is a topic that has really baffled me. It's given me a lot of headaches over the years, and I know that other people here have had trouble with it as well. So the topic, of course, is anatta, which is usually translated as no self. So what does that mean? What did the Buddha say, and what did he not say about self and not self? And how can we practice with it? Because otherwise, it's just sort of an esoteric entertainment. So just to back up a little bit, the Buddha talked a lot about what we call the three characteristics that he said are three fundamental characteristics of existence. So just briefly, anicca is impermanence. So that one's fairly easy to grasp intellectually, although I think we tend to look at it in a fairly superficial way. And I'm not going to be anything less than superficial tonight, because we just don't have enough time to go there. But at least we know that everything changes. We look in a mirror, we see gray hair. We drive down the street, the neighbors painted their house a different color. You visit some town that you went to 30 years ago, and you don't know how to find your way around. So we know about change, or at least we think we do. So I'll leave it at that. Then there's suffering. Dukkha, the big D, dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, which to me sounds kind of gothic. And we were once teaching this course, and somebody in the class said, I don't have suffering. I have a pretty good life. So how does this apply to me? So I asked, well, how about anxiety? She said, bingo. So I think suffering is really not a great translation, and partly because suffering, again, it sounds kind of like a Halloween thing. Dukkha is really about stress, it's about anxiety, it's about angst, it's about unease, it's about that subtle sense that things aren't quite right. And it can be very, very subtle. You could be on a tropical beach at sunset, beautiful balmy weather, piña colada in your hand. And you think to yourself, I wish this could go on forever. You notice how you've already introduced this subtle friction that keeps you from fully enjoying the moment out there on the beach? You know, you've introduced a story about yourself. I wonder if I could come back next year. Wish we'd done this years ago. You start coming up with a story, and the story always involves yourself. There is a metaphor that we like a lot around here. It's called the second arrow. And basically what it's saying is that there are a lot of things that happen that are unavoidable. You're going to get old. You're going to get injured. You're going to have things happen to you that you'd rather not happen. Unpleasant things. Injury. The Buddha himself, even after his enlightenment, he had injuries, he had bad knees, he had a bad back. In the last months of his life, he had a very painful intestinal disorder. And in the last year of his life, two of his chief followers died, Moggallana and Sariputta. And he said that that was like losing the sun and the moon. So he had grief, he had physical pain. He had a very different relationship to that physical pain than we might. The second arrow is when we add to that. Now your knee hurts, as knees often do. But then you start thinking, this is so much worse than it was for me last year. I think I'm going to have to get a knee replacement soon. I wish I was young again. It's sort of, you start adding story, and you start adding story about yourself, and you end up having a lot more suffering from that story than you do from the actual pain in your knee. In fact, by the time you've gone through the story, your knee might have just stopped hurting altogether. So the second arrow is when we make it personal. That's sort of why I'm bringing all of this up, is because it ties in, all these three characteristics are tied together. It's said that if you understand any one of them, then you understand all three. Oh, and by the way, you're enlightened. So when it's personal, when the suffering, when we make what's inevitable or unavoidable become personal, we get clinging, which is the second noble truth. The first noble truth is that there is dukkha. The second noble truth is that there's dukkha. There's a cause to dukkha, and the cause is clinging. So, here's a sutta, because what's a Dharma talk without a sutta? This one is called The Leash, and I have edited it, because as if you've read suttas, and many of you have, they're long, they're repetitive. Just as a dog tied by a leash to a post keeps running around and circling around that very post, in the same way an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, like me, assumes form to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He assumes feeling to be the self, or the self as possessing feeling. He assumes perception to be the self, or the self as possessing perception. He assumes mental fabrications to be the self, or the self as possessing fabrications. He assumes consciousness to be the self, or the self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in the self, or the self as in consciousness. He keeps running around and running around. He is not set loose from form, not set loose from feeling, from perception, from fabrications, not set loose from consciousness. He is not set loose from birth, aging, and death, from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs. He is not set loose, I tell you, from suffering and stress. See, some of you may recognize that. He's going through the five aggregates, which are in Buddhadhamma, the five components that are necessary, but perhaps not sufficient, for all experience, for all of our knowing of the world. So he's saying that you're not your thoughts, you're not your opinions, you're not your body, you're not your memories, which, okay, we can sort of understand that. If you forget something, are you a different person? I hope not. I had the experience of going to my 45th high school reunion last night, and in some ways I was a very different person, but I really was the same person. Kind of a mystery there. So one way of looking at this is that there is no self, it's just a delusion that leads to clinging, which is the cause of dukkha. Okay, we can all go home now. But this kind of leads to some problems. So one of them, and this is sort of a big, we'll see. It's kind of an aside. If there is no self, who gets reborn? Whether or not you believe in rebirth, and people have divided opinions here, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But if there is no self, what gets reborn? And the Buddha often talked about rebirth, and it was widely, although not universally, believed at the time. So he sort of talked many times as if it was taken for granted. He even gave talks where he'd say things like, and I'm sort of roughly paraphrasing, if you're vain, you'll be reborn as an ugly person. If you're a miser, you'll be reborn as a poor person. That kind of thing. Sort of a rebirth as a punitive measure. Ajahn Sumedho says, what's reborn, I'm afraid, is your bad habits. So it's your karma. In this model, your actions and the consequences that await those actions. And there's a very detailed breakdown in the Abhidhamma. I mean, it's really technical. I'm not going to try to go into it here, about what happens in the last moments of life with the karma as it sort of gets packaged up to move to the initial mind moments of the next life. Anyway, it's incredibly detailed. I'm not going to go into that now. And interestingly, it does not match the Tibetan model. Ajahn Amaro says that it's important to remember that it's not a thing that's reborn, that's sort of pitching some karma over the fence. It is it's part of an ongoing process. And what's being reborn is suffering. So if you're a compassionate person, you want to try to stop the suffering. So that's why you behave well in this world. Even though there may not, it may not be yourself ending up on the other side, somebody's going to have that suffering, so you want to try to lessen it as much as possible in this world. But I sort of can't help but think, why worry? If it's somebody else's problem, why don't I just throw it over the fence? So that's another problem with this model. And there are other problems here, but I want to move on. I like to hold the issue of rebirth with don't know mine, because I really don't know. There is, by the way, a sutta that I really like called the Safe Bet Sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. And I would read it, but it's very long, and there wasn't any part of it that I could sort of pull out neatly and tidily. So I'm just going to paraphrase it. And what it is essentially is that there are these people saying, well, I'm going to bet that there's no rebirth and I'm going to whoop it up. And other people are saying, I'm betting there is rebirth, so I'm going to be really, really good. And the Buddha says that assume for a minute that there is rebirth, then you want to behave ethically because then you'll be reborn in a higher realm or better lifetime. And if you behave unethically, you're going to be reborn in a lower realm. So it's to your benefit to behave ethically. If there is no rebirth and you behave well, you're going to be happy. You're going to be happier. And if you behave badly, you're going to be unhappy. Now, I don't think I would have bought this when I was 20 years old, but at my age, I really believe this to be true. I regret, I have remorse over every unethical thing that I've done, at least the ones that I remember. So I really buy that. Interestingly, this Safe Bet Sutta from the Buddha's time is identical to something called Pascal's Wager, which is from Western philosophy. Pascal just used heaven and hell instead of better rebirth or worse rebirth. And it's interesting that they both used wagering as the metaphor. So we talked about what gets reborn. But there's another problem with no self, just setting aside the rebirth issue. The problem is, and this may sound trivial, but it isn't, who do you see in the mirror? And we have a sense of self, a very natural sense of self. Should we discard that? In philosophy, there's this reasonableness principle that if a proposition is not reasonable, then you have to either discard it or set it aside. So there's something about no self that we find really difficult, because I know who brushes my teeth in the morning. There's another problem, and that is, who is it who might become enlightened? Or even know a little bit more freedom? Why would we care if there's no self? But does the Buddha really say that there's no self? So, here's another sutta. Oh good, it's not at the bottom of the stack. This is actually called the Ananda Sutta. Ananda was the Buddha's personal attendant for many, many years. But actually, the most interesting character, I think, is Vajragata. Then the wanderer Vajragata went to the Blessed One. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he asked the Blessed One, "Now then, Venerable Gautama, is there a self?" When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. "Then there is no self." A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then Vajragata, the wanderer, got up from his seat and left. I sort of imagine him rolling his eyes. And then not long after, Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer?" "Ananda," he said, "if I were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, which is the view that there is an eternal, unchanging soul. If I were to answer that there is no self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism, the view that death is the end, that there is no rebirth, and therefore they make, I think, the mistaken conclusion that there are no consequences to moral actions. If I were to answer that there is a self, what would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are impersonal? No, Lord. And if I were to answer that there is no self, the bewildered Vatchagata would become even more bewildered. Does the self that I used to have now not exist? So the Buddha refuses to answer the question of whether or not there's a self. He doesn't even tell Ananda at the end of all this. I do want to note that there are two extremes that he's rejecting specifically here. One is about the eternal unchanging soul. And just a note here for the wonks among you. Anatta means not atta. In Pali, an or a means not, when you tack it on at the beginning of a word. And atta is a Pali word. The Sanskrit equivalent is atman. And you may remember from your comparative religions course that atman is sometimes translated as the oversoul, sort of a super soul that we're all sort of a part of and seeking to rejoin. So this is something that the Buddha very clearly rejected, the idea that there's a super soul or any kind of internal, permanent, unchanging soul. He also rejects annihilationism because he really clearly believes that there's karma and that there's consequences to our actions. So notice that he is, again, finding a middle ground, as he does so often, between the extremes of his time. Another sutta. There is a case where an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, there's that phrase again, does not discern what ideas are fit for attention or what ideas are unfit for attention. This is how he attends inappropriately. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What was I in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I be in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the immediate present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where is it bound? As he attends inappropriately in this way, one of six kinds of view arises in him. The view, I have a self, arises in him as true and established. Or the view, I have no self. Or the view, it is precisely by means of self that I perceive self. Or the view, it is precisely by means of self that I perceive not self. Or the view, it is precisely by means of not self that I perceive self, arises in him as true and established. Or else he has a view like this. This very self of mine, the knower that is sensitive here and there to the ripening of good and bad actions, is the self of mine that is constant, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will stay just as it is for eternity. This is called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views. I like this, a writhing of views, a fetter of views. So he's saying, I mean, this is clearly that he's not just rejecting some permanent soul like Atman. He's also rejecting all kinds of view of self as being a confusion. He's also saying, and this is important, that not self as a view is just as confusing as self. And you could sort of see that if you cling to the view of no self, you're creating a sense of self. I'm the guy who gets this. Or as Ed Brown would say, no self, that's for me. So the Buddha doesn't say that there's no self. Again, he refuses to answer. He does say that the question is silly. So he does explain why he doesn't answer in this sutta, which is a long one, so I better take a drink of water. This is a long one. I've edited a lot out. Many of you know this already. It's the Poisoned Arrow Sutta. I don't think that's what it's called, but that's what I call it. So it starts with a monk comes, a follower of the Buddha, comes and sits down with the Buddha, and he complains to the Buddha that the Buddha's not answering all these metaphysical questions that he has. And there will be a list of these questions later on. I mean, they go through them all over and over again before this. But this is the Buddha's response to this monk. It's just as if a man were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, would provide him with a surgeon, and the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or golden colored, until I know his home, village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a long bow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring was fiber, bamboo threads, sinew, hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft was wild or cultivated, until I know whether the feathers of the shaft were those of a vulture, a stork, a hawk, a peacock, or another bird. I sort of get the feeling that the other monks in the room are starting to nudge each other in the elbows and suppressing giggles. Until I know whether the shaft, almost through now, until I know whether the shaft was bound with the sinew of an ox, a water buffalo, a langur, or a monkey. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was that of a common arrow, a curved arrow, a barbed, a calf-toothed, or an oleander arrow. The man would die, and those things would still remain unknown to him. So remember what is undeclared by me as undeclared, and what is declared by me is declared, and what is undeclared by me? The cosmos is eternal, is undeclared by me. The cosmos is not eternal. The cosmos is finite. The cosmos is infinite. The soul and the body are the same. The soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Tathagata, an enlightened one, exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. After death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, is undeclared by me. And why are they undeclared by me? Because they are not connected with the goal, are not fundamental to the holy life. They do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, calming, direct knowledge, self-awakening, unbinding. That's why they are undeclared by me. And what is declared by me? This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. This is the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Recognize that? Four items there. What's interesting, this is Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation, and he uses stress instead of suffering, which I like, so I kept it that way. And why is the Four Noble Truths declared by me? Because they are connected with the goal, are fundamental to the holy life. They lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, calming, direct knowledge, self-awakening, unbinding. That's why they are declared by me. So the reason he doesn't answer all these metaphysical questions, including the ones about self and cosmos and everything else, is because they don't help with the fundamental sense, the fundamental issue of ending dukkha. So if you look at this whole issue of self and not self as being kind of an esoteric exercise, one thing you could do is you could always just go back to the Four Noble Truths, because that was his core teaching that he went to over and over again. And this other stuff is all sort of a footnote. I think a useful footnote potentially, but if it's really giving you problems, you can do like I did for many years. I just set it aside until, well, I'll get to this in a little while. Here's another aside, by the way. Whatever your opinions are about self or no self, no self can be known experientially. And a lot of you have actually had this experience, I know from conversations. You may describe this as in different words, and generally people who've had this have had it very briefly. It doesn't last very long. People sometimes describe it as emptiness or as a clarity or a lucidity. There's so often immediately an experience of, wow, this is cool, and it all goes away. Or, wow, this is scary, and it all goes away. And as that indicates, it can be liberating. It can also be a little frightening, which is why practice does require a certain level of strength of self. If you're really going to deep practice, it requires some confidence and some faith, which leads to an irony. To know no self, you really must know self. That's K-N-O, not N-O, self. But back to the problem of self. We've been skirting around this. Who is it that brushes your teeth? So the Buddha often talks about the self as if it does exist. He gives advice that would be appropriate for a Dear Abby column. He talks to people about things that are required for happiness, like good friends, good work, good digestion, ethical behavior. I mean, he goes and talks to people as if they have selves and gives very basic, fundamental advice. So maybe we can say that the self fundamentally doesn't exist, but in a mundane or provisional way, it does exist. So this seems to solve some problems, and many teachers have adopted this approach. Ajahn Amaro says, and I don't think he exactly would agree with me on this, but it's still a good quote, so I'll use it. Self is part of an ongoing universal process. But if a cop pulls you over for speeding, you really shouldn't tell her that you're part of, and she asks you who you are, you really shouldn't tell her you're part of a universal ongoing process. This would just not go over well. You're really much better off showing her your driver's license. One teacher was asked, is the self real? And the teacher answered, the self is real, but the self is not really real. But there's a problem with this two-layered reality. Well, first of all, the Buddha never said anything about two layers of reality, and you'd think it'd be important enough that he would bring it up. And then the other thing is, where do we draw the line between this absolute and relative realities? Because it sounds like there's some dividing line that's outside of us that is, you know, there's really not a self at some level and really a self at some other level. That means there is, maybe there's a gray area, maybe there's a very clear dividing line. I don't know. I'm uncomfortable with that. So Tanisaro Bhikkhu says that it's not about a grand metaphysical truth. It's about skillful practice. He says that, first of all, self is not a thing, it's a process. When I read this not so long ago, I went, first I went, aha. And then I went, it's so obvious. Why didn't I get this before? Did I miss the memo? Why didn't you guys tell me? So self is not who we are. Self is something that we do. So we've heard the word selfing, and it sounds kind of cute, but in a way, it actually, cute in a bad way, but actually it's a very useful word because it treats self as a verb instead of a noun. So again, to paraphrase Tanisaro Bhikkhu, perception of self is an action of creating me and mine. So this opens up all kinds of possibilities, because if self is an action, the Buddha spoke consistently about two kinds of actions, skillful and unskillful, not about relative and absolute. He talked about skillful and unskillful actions. So I would suggest that brushing your teeth involves a skillful view of yourself. So what I think he's getting at is that the real question is, when is it skillful to have a view of yourself, and when is it unskillful? Or what is a skillful view of the self? What's an unskillful view of the self? So what is a skillful practice with regard to self? Tanisaro Bhikkhu says, this is a quote from a book of his, as a first step in putting an end to the suffering, you have to bring awareness to the process by which you create your sense of self so that you can clearly see what you're doing and why it's causing that suffering. Again, as a first step in putting an end to this suffering, you have to bring awareness to the process by which you create your sense of self so that you can clearly see what you're doing and why it's causing that suffering. So this sort of implies that you are creating yourself moment by moment, and you're free to make choices as you go along, which is kind of scary and kind of amazing. So how are you free to make these choices? I mean, this can be hard to perceive as things are chugging along, you're having a bad day at the office, or having a conversation with your sister-in-law or something. Well, it's about mindfulness. Mindfulness is sort of like duct tape. It has a light side and a dark side, and it holds everything together. So meditation is what gives you the steadiness of mind, the focus that you need to perceive this freedom and to act out of your intentions. It's what develops the mindfulness so that you actually start seeing the degrees of freedom that you have moment by moment in creating yourself. Yourself isn't this unchangeable thing. You no longer have the excuse of, that's how I roll. You don't have to be a slave to your habits. Or as what some title of a book says, you can break the habit of who you are. So I'm not going to suggest further steps in this practice here, but I think obviously it has a lot to do with mindfulness. So we have quite a bit of time for questions and answers. You notice I left a lot of things sort of untied or half untied. So please, I'm going to be disciplined and repeat the question, because our handheld mic is taped to the stand here. Questions, observations, rants, opinions?
Could you just repeat the duct tape metaphor?
it's actually a Star Wars joke. It's the force is like duct tape, but it applies to mindfulness. The mindfulness is like duct tape. It has a dark side and a light side, and it holds the universe together.
And what's the dark side?
Well, mindfulness can be, you can be mindful in an unethical way. You know, somebody who is a safe cracker or a cat burglar is being pretty mindful about what's going on, or a pickpocket. This is a very model of mindfulness. But that doesn't lead to happiness, doesn't lead to the end of suffering. So that's why mindfulness, it's good to remember, has a dark side and a light side. Thanks for the question. And we want to stay on the light side of it.
I have a comment, just when you were talking about the idea of creating self. I had an experience this morning, which I don't really want to repeat. It was perfectly just like that, where I was in a situation where something was happening, and I felt all these judgments of the person that was speaking, and I was aware right then that I could close off half the universe by my judgments and not be open to seeing somebody as a human being. And I had to fight with myself it was a struggle. Like, no, you're not going to have these judgments. Anyway, it was very interesting. It was just exactly what you said, because it is an ongoing thing, or can be.
Mm-hmm. That's a great insight. That's very interesting, your description. Did everyone hear that? I'll repeat it. Just to be brief, Katie had an experience of watching the self arising this morning in the form of strong judgment. And watching the judgment arise and then trying to handle that judgment skillfully, and also noticing just how difficult it was to be skillful about dealing with the judgment. Is that a fair summary?
Oh, yes. Yeah, but I also was aware at the same time that having that judgment and living just in that judgment without anything else was a way of closing off from that particular experience and from God knows how many others because of other...
Right.
I didn't know if it's because I'm old or just because I always felt like that or whatever, but it was enlightening.
So notice that the judgment was really cutting off her perception. It was cutting off half of the world, was her words. So that's a great insight, to notice the way judgment limits your scope of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Who was the author that you quoted at the end?
Thanissaro Bhikkhu.
I got the Bhikkhu. Who's...
Okay, it's T-H-A-N-I... S-S-A-R-O. He's one of our primary translators of Pali. He's also known as Ajahn Jeff. Because his real name is Jeff. And he's very opinionated and insightful. The book that had such an impact on me is called Self and Not Selves. You can find it online. My recommendation is to read just the introduction and the first chapter. The following chapters are really kind of a commentary. And if you really get caught up in it, that would be fine. But I recommend that highly.
And then I made a note to myself about if we are reborn and it's our bad stuff or our good stuff that goes on. I just wanted to say,
yeah.
If it's our bad stuff, I fear for the world. Because it just seems to me that there's an opportunity that's missed.
Well, different teachers have different opinions about that.
So I liked that you put that down and went on.
Right. I think that the Hindu model is that all karma, even good karma, is eventually to be discarded. And different Buddhist teachers treat this differently. So I think I'm an optimist, so I would take the optimist view.
So you have bad habits and good bad habits. Or bad habits and good bad habits.
Sure, you have good bad habits and you have bad habits. And the other question, by the way, was just which I was answering was, I forgot to repeat it, was is it just bad karma that's passed along, or is it good and bad karma? Because she fears for the world if it's just the bad karma. Mary?
I was just thinking about the role of intention in all of this. And I'm in the middle of reading the Chaos of Clarity with my son. We're reading that together and talking about what your values are, what your intentions are, and doing all these other things. And it's almost like you're creating this person who has these intentions, you know what I mean, these intentions and these values. But then in the moment, because you're sitting here, but then in the moment of your life, you're wanting to respond rather than react to things because you want to have this. It's almost like you're trying to be this conduit. Mm-hmm. So I kind of think of no self is actually like this conduit of those things that you're trying to hold together, like, you know, and bring to bear at that particular moment. Mm-hmm. But then it's almost like the intention is like, to me sometimes the intention ends up being a little bit more solid. So I don't know how it quite fits into that picture when everything's in a kind of a state of flux.
So the observation is that when you're in the middle of it's easy to think about intention and to get in touch with it when you're on the cushion or in a quiet room. It's much harder when you're in the middle of a situation, when you're at work or dealing with family. And she has found it helpful to focus on no self as a way of staying in touch with her intention. And that's a great practice if that works for you. I think it's also something that improves with practice, responding rather than reacting, which are Philip Moffat's phrases. Reacting when you're sort of, most of the time we're like on automatic pilot. We're like Pavlov's dogs. We react without even thinking about our reaction. When we respond, we're starting to actually get close to that sense of freedom where we're actually deciding what to do. Or as I put it earlier, what kind of self do you want to be? Do I want to be a jerk or do I want to be a kind person? Do I want to break an old habit where I would normally say something unskillful? Or do I want to just be quiet and see how that works out? So I think meditation is enormously helpful because if you start to be aware of a particular place where you tend to react rather than respond, and start being more aware of it as it's happening, after a while, you start to perceive that little bit of the metaphor people use so often is space between the provocation, that's what it is, and your response. And after a while, you actually suddenly have a little bit of freedom in that space. We had some convicts here speak recently, and they say that with meditation, with the practice, they started to find the space between the anger and the violence, or the space between the craving and the using. And I thought this was a great Dharma teaching, because it's the practice that allows you to start finding that space, and in that space is your freedom of choosing which way you're going to go. Linda?
I really like the concept of self as a process, like an ongoing process. And I think it really ties in with the teaching that Donald Rothberg gave us about the thick self and the thin self. And it really, that for the first time, really started to help clarify self for me, that when I'm full of emotion and reaction, I've got this big, thick self. I happened to walk into Sangha that night with a nice, thick self, so it was really helpful. And I could see, as less becomes reactive and more of my focus is out there and not in here, that self thins out. So it's more like a spectrum that, you know, eventually I could see perhaps the ideal is this non-self. But just this thick self, thin self, and this process and spectrum really held up for me, as opposed to self, no self, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what she's saying is, and a guest teacher talked about thick self versus thin self. Thick self is when we're really in the middle of it, when we're really reactive, and you know we're just, you know, the hell with the, you know, it's like, you know, you're just totally wrapped up in some situation, and you just have no choice at all. Thin self is when you're less grabby about stuff, and you have more space for some freedom, or even some serenity around something, and that this is. Awareness is a good way to sort of thin out the self. And a very helpful model, rather than no self or self, which is sort of like hitting a light switch, you can see it as being continuum rather than as being a yes or no situation, which I think is very helpful.
I'm just curious. I've never heard a teacher talk about inherited tendencies. For instance, shyness,
right.
Temperament. Does that not matter, or does that fall within the scope of choice? And I think it does.
So the question is, what about innate characteristics? I mean, some characters, and shyness is a good example, because it turns out that shyness is something that shows up so early in children that it doesn't seem to be environmental. It seems very likely, at least the last time I read the research in this area, is that it seems to be genetic. So I think that's sort of we're also in bodies where some of us are left-handed, some of us are right-handed, some of us have good eyesight, some of us have poor eyesight, and we can't really change that. So I think that a lot of this skillful view of self is about working with our strengths and our limitations.
So I was very interested in understanding that Buddha never wrote about the two levels.
Right.
And so let me try to lay out a couple of things, and then I would love it if you could speak a little more about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm new to all of this relatively, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about teachings about tree, for example, that at the ordinary level of reality, we're in trouble if we don't react to it as a tree that we can bump our nose into. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there is no tree. There is sunlight and earth and nutrients and everything that is together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a tree. So that's sort of a duality.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is that it stops, that maybe this is about the fact that there is no real duality even, that the further work, if you really get deeper into it, there is no distinction between those two descriptions. And just one of the personal experiences is that at the end of the last, of a long retreat at Spirit Rock, I had the very sobering experience about mindfulness that I was being, I thought, exquisitely mindful about cleaning the room I was staying off campus and leaving it perfect for the people whose house I was staying in. As a result of which, I was pretty close to being late for the closing ceremony, about which I've been completely unmindful. So it's the same kind of duality of trying to figure out, is there really a a skillful practice, or is really skillful something that you have to know in order to then realize that there is no such thing as a distinction between skillful and unskillful, and so on. So it comes back in some way to asking you if you could say a little bit more about what's your sense of why does the Buddha never talk about it?
Well, this is an interesting question. He brings up and uses as an example a tree. Sometimes you can look at a tree as something that doesn't exist. It's sunlight, it's atoms, it's, you know, it was, or as one teacher says, it was once a sapling, but now it's a tree. When did it change? Was there a dividing line when it stopped being a sapling and became a tree? On the other hand, if you're driving a car, you don't want to drive your car into the tree. You need to treat the tree as if it's a real tree. So the Buddha didn't talk about there being two levels of reality, like, oh yes, there really is no tree, but on another level there is a tree. And so is it just introducing a different duality to say that it's a skillful practice to act as if there's a tree, and in other situations maybe it's a skillful practice to not treat it as a tree, you know, to see its impermanence, to see its unreliability, and what was the last part of the question? That there was something about mindfulness, because you had been very mindful about one situation, but you were not so mindful about another situation. And I think to answer the second question first, I think mindfulness is very often about balances, and skillful view of self is also a lot about balances. There really is going to be, you know, sometimes you're in a hurry, you have to brush your teeth faster than you'd like to overwork the metaphor I was using earlier. And I think that the mindfulness of cleaning up your room and getting to someplace is about a skillful view of self, or at least some view of self, whether skillful, unskillful, is just adding another duality or not. And maybe skillful, unskillful is adding a duality, but at least I find it a more useful one than exists or doesn't exist, but there's a dividing line somewhere. And I better figure out where that dividing line is. Is it just when I get into a car or when I'm about to bump into the tree? Or should I really spend a lot of time not seeing the tree? So at least for me, the skillful versus unskillful is useful. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's useful. Is that helpful?
What if there's not two levels, but what if there's a million levels, a million perspectives for any phenomenon, you know, that we're experiencing?
Oh, we're getting into calculus. No, I'm just joking. I'm sorry.
I mean, think about it.
Right. Right.
At one level, that tree is so insignificant because it's just a tiny part of a tiny planet, which is almost, you know, cosmos to me. In another way, it's a very big deal that you're about to run into. In another way, it is constantly changing, even now, you know. And all those perspectives, you know, maybe a million,
right,
perspectives, and all that one.
So he's speculating that it may not be just a level of real versus not real, with one dividing line. There may be millions of them, of dividing lines. It may be some sort of continuum. That may be so. You know, we could have a very interesting conversation over beer.
I wouldn't even divide them. They're all ever present now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And that may be so.
Yes.
And I'm not going to try to answer it because it makes my head throb, and also because it's sort of like it's a very interesting speculation, but in some ways the issue of working with your practice, it may be one of those things where it would be fun to sit down and really think it out at some point. Now, I'm not saying don't speculate. Speculation is fun, but keep in mind that you try to keep it within the context of your, keep it in perspective with your practice. And at least as we try to practice it, practice is lessening suffering. You know, can you lessen your own suffering and the suffering of the world around you? So speculate away, but...
I think part of it goes back to why we call it practice. I mean, mindfulness is knowing the context, knowing what perspective to apply. So do I apply the self and other as I drive toward the tree? Yes, that would be useful.
All right.
And it is significant, so yes. And then if, in the case of whether I want to go to the opening ceremony or clean my rooms, what are the values that I'm embodying here? So you practice with these contexts, and as you say, it's balance. And you learn how to keep the important contexts in your mind.
So she's saying, and the magic word which she didn't use, but I think that's what she's getting at, is sapajana, or clear comprehension. Part of mindfulness is knowing what's appropriate, avoiding running into the tree. Mm-hmm. The Buddha used it for having enough clear comprehension to find a good place to meditate, you know, finding a place to sit down. You do need a sense of self. So I think that's part of a skillful sense of self is, you know, getting yourself to sit down and meditate, or developing your practice, or avoiding running into the tree. And so on. Is that a good summary? I know you went on. Okay. Mary?
Lately, I've really started to get this idea a bit. And it's been through when I find myself miserable, when I'm unhappy, and then to think, okay, what am I doing? You know, what's going on? And then recognizing that I'm doing some form of aversion or clinging or whatever. And that's creating a self, you know, it's a self who's a victim or whatever, you know, but it's been very helpful to see the kind of evolution of this self that comes about by the very act of being miserable.
So Mary was saying that she really works a lot with the notion of self when she's unhappy, because she looks for how she's identifying and how that creating a self gets her stuck in that unhappiness. So that's a great exercise. Another exercise, which is actually harder to do, is when you're happy, notice how what kind of dynamic is happening there. And notice how you may be impeding that happiness as well. Another exercise, which I think is unrelated, but I really like this, is when you're happy, notice the physical sensations. Is that? I want to get.
Yes. I just wanted to say that I really appreciated the comments of these two gentlemen. This was kind of what I was thinking, but wasn't ready to articulate it as eloquently. Mm-hmm. And I just want to add that concept of continuum, I just take great solace in knowing that there's this continuum and it doesn't have to be answered.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think another way to look at it is the Buddha talked about skillful and unskillful actions, but I think that sort of implies that there are unskillful actions and really unskillful actions, and skillful actions and really, really skillful actions. I think that there's a continuum there as well in how we look at the world, how we respond to it.
I just did an exercise once in an art class where someone put something, a thing, a box or something on the table, and different people had to draw from where they were sitting that box, and it was all very, very different. And just the idea of we do have selves that we have to contend with our what we see, what we understand due to conditions or whatever, and that's what we have to be mindful of, like you were, like saying what he said, how are we causing suffering by this identity of creating some kind of identity.
So she's pointing out that she was at a art exercise where people in different parts of the room were drawing a picture of a box. So, of course, everybody gets a different view of the box, which reminds me of the famous elephant sutta where a bunch of different people feel the elephant and get into big fights about what the elephant looks like, because they all have a different idea of what an elephant looks like. Which is a very interesting thing about opinion, too, and about views, how we get caught up in them. So, yeah, I think this is
another
topic. But it is a very interesting thing to remember that we are not our views. And we really get caught up in our views. Alice?
Okay.
This is going to be the last one.
Okay. I have always been puzzled when they say that you have to love yourself to understand no self. And I think I get it, but I just want to run it by you. So I think that when I take offense or I'm feeling like really low self-esteem, my no self is not apparent. I'm really big. Like when I think of no self, I'm more connected to other people and I'm not so self-important.
Yes.
So that's what they mean by you have to love yourself. You have to have, in order to have no self or to let go of yourself, you have to love yourself.
So she's saying that in order to let go of yourself, you have to love yourself. And I don't know if, you know, I don't know if I put it that strongly, because I certainly don't love myself a lot of the time, maybe most of the time. I think there has to be a certain kind of core strength, maybe a confidence in self. Love may be a good way of looking at it. Another measure might be the ability to have compassion for oneself, because that's a tough one for us. Mm-hmm. But I think that what you're saying is true, that that people who are, and therapists know this already, that it's very hard to work if you're drowning and all you've got is a piece of wood. It's very hard to let go of that wood. If you're sitting on a beach, then it's very easy to toss the wood aside. So I don't know how clear that metaphor is, but if you're really struggling with the world and don't have a very strong sense of self, it's very hard to let that sense of self go, even for small periods of time. And some people do get quite frightened by that experience, that meditation experience of no self. I know of some cases that are really quite unfortunate. Is that?
Yeah, I think that answers my question. I just know that when I'm feeling rejected or feeling, you know, miserable, then I'm taking up the whole room.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when I'm not in that state,
right,
I'm much more open to everybody around me.
Right. No, I know that feeling when it's all about me. Yeah, I know that. And it's hard to let go of that. So, let's let go of our talk tonight, thinking. Settle down again.